Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist. How are you tonight, Laura?
Recovering from a great Thanksgiving holiday. How about yourself?
From one you have to recover from, huh?
I'm doing very well. I was inspired today, and I worked on my closet.
Oh, that's a good something to do on a rainy, fallish, almost winter afternoon in Louisville.
I got quite a bit done. It's not done, but I got rid of some stuff, and I got a little organized. It's true. I think
that's
my mother-in-law saved me
it?
Into it. She came in my closet, and she goes, we're walking out. She says, what do you need all of those clothes for?
As only that's a mother-in-law can do, huh?
I like clothes, and I just blew her off with that. I like clothes. So Laura tried to save me. She said, well, we do share clothes, too, so it's not just hers. I'm like, thank you, Laura. That was very nice. Anyway,
oh,
but it inspired me to go through some junk. Lord knows I could get rid of at least half of what's still in there, but I can't, so I did my
best.
Well,
it's the start. Good for you. That is great.
Thank you.
That is great. Okay, we are hopefully tonight going to finish up this series, this never-ending five-part series on social skills that toddlers need as a prerequisite for developing language. This is show number 138, and this is the fifth in our series about social skills, and I think we can finish it tonight, hopefully. Announcements before we get started. This week is my conference in Lexington, Kentucky on Friday, December 2nd, and we still have spots. So if you want to come, please register and join us. I would love to have you there. And I think that's my only other announcement tonight, other than we're about to have a huge mega blowout sale for the holidays and for celebrating our fourth anniversary at TeachMeToTalk.com. So that sale will start probably as soon as the show ends today, and I can get the post up. So if you've wanted to get DVDs or and even the therapy manuals are going to be on sale, and I never put those on sale. So if you've wanted those, buy something for yourself for the holidays and go ahead and order those. So that'll be starting again at about 7:15 Eastern time tonight after the show. So those are our announcements.
Cool.
All right.
And how
let's
goes the new venture?
Hopefully that'll be for sale by the end of the week. I'm not going to talk too much about it tonight other than to say I'm so excited. My best quality is often my worst quality, which is having really high standards. So that's I wish that DVD were for sale tonight. That had been our plan, but it's not quite ready yet. So hopefully, since it's a Christmas DVD, it'll be ready sometime this week. But I just keep thinking, it's not even December 1st. It's no big deal. It's okay. So I'm thrilled about it, how it's turning out. But it's just not quite ready for sale yet. So that'll be this week, though. And that's
really
all we're
going
to say about that. I'll talk to you about that after the show, Kate, okay?
Okay.
All right. We have spent 4 weeks now, this is the fifth week, talking about social skills in toddlers. And remember, the things that we want to see is that our little friends, even as 1- and 2-year-olds, want to be with other people. We want them to have eye contact. We want them to have joint attention without self-absorption or self-stimulatory behaviors most of the time. We want them to laugh and smile during play with us. And even when we're playing with toys, we don't want to disappear just because a toy is there. We want them to be able to focus on objects and people at the same time. And those were the first three shows. In last week's show, we also talked a lot about turn-taking and what that really means and why that's a prerequisite for acquiring language. And we also talked about using simple and purposeful gestures and how to recognize those, what those gestures mean for symbolic communication. And so if you're not quite sure what I'm talking about with any of those milestones, boy, have we got four shows for you, because we talked those things to death.
And how did you get through all of that in 2 minutes? That's what we should have just done that, Laura.
Nobody then would have known. A lot of people would have said, oh, my kid does that, or, oh, the kids on my caseload do that. It's when we talk about it and talk about it and talk about it that people recognize and realize what we're talking about. And that's how we ended the show last week, with how lots of therapists know these things from an intellectual perspective, but they haven't really thought about how they're supposed to look in
right.
real live kids. And so, or moms especially too, they might read this list and think, oh, my child doesn't have any problems with that. And often I get letters or emails on the website that say, oh, I know my kid doesn't have autism, but he has all these things. And I want to say, I haven't seen your kid, and I can't make a diagnosis online. However, I think your kid might be on the spectrum. And mm-hmm. and it's just funny how reading a list or looking at a list really superficially, how you can miss so many things, especially in children that you love and adore. And we talked about how that happens even with us as therapists, how we see a child really, quote-unquote, perform in sessions, and how we might miss that a child has just learned to be social in the context of that routine and hasn't really generalized those nice skills. And while it's a beginning and we certainly want to see those things, sometimes even when we really objectively look at our clients in a different context, we see that those skills are not being carried over. And in typically developing children, these things are non-issues. These are things that children acquire without anyone ever paying attention to them. They just happen because they're the prerequisites for language development. And so if you have a child that's developing typically and who's moving along cognitively and who's starting to acquire words and they know what words mean, they already have most of these things or all of these things instinctively because these things have kicked in. And, again, nobody ever really gave it a second thought. It's just been there all along. And so that's why it's important to talk about these things, because these are things that people, even therapists, very often miss. So I'm glad that this is our fifth show on this series, because it's really important. And because, again, we talked about this, we don't always get this in our formal education. We might get a list, we might get a brief description, but we don't often talk about it in real life, everyday scenarios, and give as much attention to it as we should, even professionally, even as therapists. And I know that might shock some parents to hear me say that, but most of the time, speech pathologists have had next to no training on identifying social skill deficits in toddlers or in children in general. So it's really, really important to pay attention and talk about it. And I know you were just kidding when you said I should have just read the list and been done with it, huh?
Oh, I am. I am. It's just it's easy to go on and on. It's such a big deal. But,
yeah.
You know, Laura, just for the record, as far as the social skills thing, with my master's in interdisciplinary early childhood education, again, pretty much not a topic.
Right.
I suppose if I had gone on and gotten some kind of master's, there are some that specifically deal with kids on the spectrum or autism, and that I did not do, but maybe you'd get it there. But you would think you would get it with a master's in early childhood education, and really, I did not. So,
right, and the only people that really at conferences, you know, and I've had the pleasure over the last year, almost year and a half, of speaking in lots of different states, and the only people that ever raise their hands when I say, how many of you had formal training in your grad school programs on social skill development and how to assess and identify and go on and treat those kinds of issues? If anybody in the room raises their hands, she always looks like she's under 25. You know,
mm-hmm.
it must be really, really, it's the youngest people. Or when an older person has raised their hand, I've almost always said, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that happened. And they almost always say, oh, I've only been out of grad school a year or two. You know, so it's
oh,
their second
uh-huh.
career. they've gone back to school. It's never, and we weren't even really talking about kids when I went to school and got my master's. You know, when I did my undergrad in the late 80s and my master's in the early 90s, we didn't talk about it at all. And we certainly, when I first started to practice, didn't see nearly the amount of kids on the spectrum or who are suspected to be or who have red flags for social communication disorder. We just didn't see them like we do now. And so it's so important that we review and that we talk about it and that we give good, consistent, clinical information about it, and not only with assessment but with treatment as well. So, again, not to beat a dead horse here, but it's something not everybody gets a chance to think about, talk about, learn about. So I'm glad we've done it. All right, so
well,
our last...
You know, Laura, interject quickly, and I think we kind of said this, but I was thinking about it from the flip side. If there are problems with these things, you already kind of said maybe this child might possibly be on the spectrum. But the flip side of that, and I see therapists miss this on a fairly regular basis, if all of these social prerequisite skills are intact, and by that I mean they're pretty instinctive for kids, and you can recognize, yes, he does this, he does this, he does this, all these things that we've been talking about for weeks, probably you're looking at a language problem, a real live speech problem,
right,
as opposed to a bigger...
seen that too, where a therapist... Yeah, that's in living color on our caseload right now.
Yeah,
where
I mean, and I see it on a fairly regular basis, but the point is, if all of these things, if you can objectively see a child, work with a child and say, yes, all of these things look pretty good without a whole lot of work, maybe some work, but, you know, for the most part, you can say, yes, all of these things are coming along nicely, it's probably a speech problem. And I think sometimes people don't pay enough attention to these things, and they may assume it's a bigger problem or a behavioral problem or a spectrum problem. And really, if all those social things are good, the good news is you have a lot to work with, and it's probably a communication problem. So
exactly. And then to tease that out a little, and to tease that out a little further, if you have a kid who has really good receptive language and good social skill interaction, like we've been talking about, more often than not, you know, that's a specific speech sound disorder problem or a motor planning problem versus anything else. And so it is good to look at the flip side and to point that out too. And it does help you make good diagnostic decisions about a kid, knowing that, again, this is your foundation. The really, really hard, gut-wrenching work is already done for you, and that the social skill foundation is there. But you're exactly right. Some people might dismiss these things and not pay close enough attention to, no, socially, he's okay. And start looking for, or might dismiss these things and not say that socially he's okay, so it has to be something else. So that's a great point, and I don't think we have talked about that.
Okay.
Maybe on the show.
We kind of danced around it, but it is surprising to me that, you know, sometimes therapists don't really take note of these things and don't necessarily factor it into their opinion of what might possibly be going on with a child, and they jump to erroneous conclusions because they're not factoring these things in. So when these things are intact, hey, that's great. You have a lot to work with, but let that factor into how you're looking at the issue in general and go from there.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay, good.
Okay. All right, the last three, and I think that I said on the Blog Talk Radio description of the show and on The Facebook description of the show today is that there were four remaining skills to talk about, but there are really only three, and they are so closely related. The first two are that we're actually not going to split those apart. We're going to talk about them as one big skill, and then there's one remaining skill that we've already talked about in a recent show, so we won't have to, I'm confident that we can get through these remaining three rather than four, these remaining three in the remaining time of our show, which is 44 minutes. Okay, so the two that we're going to talk about right now are that children work to get your attention when he needs something from you. And this is, really, sometimes parents miss this with their children who have really pretty glaringly obvious social communication issues, because a kid, well, for lack of a better word, the mom mind reads. The mother anticipates a child's needs just like she did when he was a newborn. And she's continued that for 2 years. So she doesn't even really realize that the child isn't initiating or isn't working to get her attention, because she just kind of instinctively knows, oh, he hasn't eaten, he must be hungry. Oh, he cries like this when he's gotten hurt. Oh, he gets scared when the vacuum is on. You know, they just know, based on all their experiences with the child up until that point, of what could possibly be wrong, and because of their maternal instincts narrow things down, and so their child doesn't have to work or doesn't have to initiate to let them know when he or she wants something. And we've already talked about that sometimes these kids are described as really easy babies because they're not very demanding. And you always, Kate, give such a good description, and such a it's so true when you say that typically developing toddlers are pretty darn demanding and pretty darn persistent with letting moms know, hey, this is what I want, and you better hurry up and get it done now, because I don't have time to wait on you to go to the bathroom or to talk on the phone or to take a shower or to do any of those things. Typically developing kids demand attention from their parents. And again, sometimes our friends who are on the spectrum, they could be moody, they could be temperamental. Those are all words that moms might use to describe them, but they're still not very demanding in that they don't constantly initiate. And we always give the example about the playpens and the baby gates, and typically developing kids don't really stand for those limits. They figure out ways around them, and they protest about them, and they want to be held, and they want to be the center of attention, and they don't really want their moms to do too much during the day that doesn't include them. And again, sometimes parents miss this because their own child isn't that way, or they just assume that it's a temperament issue. Oh gosh, he's just really laid back, he's like his dad, or something like that, without realizing that there's a social component and a social communication component that's missing in their child's development. Do you want to say something here?
Well, just that, I don't remember the exact terminology, Laura, but what did you call it when a child, oftentimes you see this with kids on the spectrum, although not exclusively, but how they, like, take a hand and move the hand to where they want it, or they take a finger and pull it across the room.
Those functional gestures versus symbolic gestures.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking.
That's why parents, like, can miss it, yeah.
Right. Point out the difference of when a typically developing child gets a parent's attention, it's a very kind of inherently social thing. They're looking at them. They're smiling. They're making some kind of face, you know, exaggerated facial expressions. It's all about eyes and their facial expressions, and they know to engage their parents that way, as opposed
right.
to a child who may be seeking attention in that they know, I need help here, I want something to eat now, and they take a hand and they pull it in the kitchen and
essentially put the hand on the counter and then wait. There's really no eye contact. There's really no facial expression. There's just taking the body to where they need it. So I'm trying to point out that difference. I'm not sure I am, but I'm trying to.
I totally get what you're saying, and that is such a good point, because when typically developing children lead or use their parents' hands, first of all, they don't do that as much as children who are, have a social problem or who go on to be diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, because they move beyond that. They move beyond the...
Quickly, yes.
Yeah, they don't have to pull and physically manipulate their parents' bodies because they do it with words. You know, mama, 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 mama. Even if that's their only darn word, boy, you know, oh my gosh, what do you want? So you will hush with the mama. You know, or they're pointing, the even the and a point is beyond.
Even if they don't, mama, mama, but they're grunting. I've had grunters who are very communicative with their, they're looking and they're smiling or they're grimacing and they're getting louder and they're pointing, and it's all about true social, you know, a facial reaction. They're reading the mom, they're reading me, whatever, and it's not just this take the hand, move it to where they want it.
Yeah.
It's a very different look.
It looks very different. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It really does. And so, and the eye contact is the way that I think most parents would really be able to tease that difference apart. If your child is just leading you and isn't emphatically looking at you and insisting that you look at them too to gauge what they want, that's the missing piece, and that's the missing socialness of that activity. And although they are, again, trying to physically manipulate your body, I always tell moms, they don't even really realize that your face is attached to your shoulder and your shoulder is attached to an arm and your arm is attached to that hand that they're leading. He doesn't get that. He just gets, you know, the big hand. The big hand can help me. He doesn't really realize all those other pieces are there, and it's not really a social activity for him. It's just a functional, let me pull you in here so that you can...
It's kind of a means to an end thing. They just
it's
really
mechanical.
Want... Yes, they have made some connection that this big body called mom, maybe don't get the mom part, but they get the big body part. You know, this important person that sits there can do things for me. They kind of get that, but they really don't have the social spark to make it a social exchange. It's just really all about getting the help they need, which is, you know, some form of communication, but very different from the socially engaged child.
Yeah, it's the one-trick pony versus a child who uses his face, his other gestures, his, you know, lots of other methods to let you know what he wants. And even
the pointing,
I love what you,
how about those kids who point like,
And if you don't get the right thing, then they're telling you no, either with a word or often even without a word. They're shaking their heads and letting you know that is not it. And
or,
sometimes
or starting to cry the minute you grab the wrong thing, they're fussing.
Yeah.
You think, well, nope, that's wrong. But it's very communicative, even without a word.
Exactly. And parents can, at this phase, with a typically developing kid, even if they don't have a lot of words or signs yet, you can still kind of play 20 questions with them. Do you want the cereal? Do you want the crackers? Do you want the goldfish? Do you want the, you know, and they can, they know, and their child is responding to that, not just standing there helplessly or not just crying and you don't know why. They're able to, in whatever means they can, still carry on that conversation and that back and forth piece to let you know, that's not it. I can't tell you what it is, but I sure can tell you, you messed up. That's not it.
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, and so this is what's missing with some of our kids is they're not really initiating beyond the pointing or the leading. Now, some kids, when you get them to finally start to point and lead, you do feel like, hallelujah, at least they're doing something to communicate. But it is the difference in that functional gesture versus the symbolic gesture. And we're not going to talk about all that again because, boy, did we talk about that last week. So if you missed that show, go back and listen to last week's show, which was part four in this series, because we talked about the difference with pointing and clapping and waving, that those are all symbols. They mean something communicatively with that gesture. And even if kids don't quite get at the beginning why they're doing those things, they quickly assign meaning to those things too, so that again they become symbols, and that's what all words are. They're just symbols. And so when a child isn't using those gestures symbolically, we know that he's not really ready to communicate yet with words or with signs, because he's not there yet cognitively. And so, again, we're not going to talk about that. That was last week's show. Go back and listen to that if you're not quite sure what I'm talking about with that or need a little refresher. So our kids who don't try to direct our behaviors, or who might try with just one means, with the pushing or pulling or putting your hand on something, and don't go beyond that with the socialness, with the looking at you and really trying to help you understand what they want, that's what's missing with lots of our kids who are, or with nearly all of our kids who are on the spectrum, because, you know, that's a core deficit. They can't really, they don't get the social part of communication. And even sometimes with our kids that are talking and say they're echolalic and that are on the spectrum, a lot of times parents might even miss that their kids aren't even really initiating in the right kind of way, because the kids might say, hold you, hold you, hold you, instead of hold me. Have you had kids that have done that, Kate, that have that their mom say, do you want me to hold you? And so they know that part of the conversation, and so that's how they initiate. And again, thank goodness that they're able to do that. Hold you, hold you, hold you. They are further along than our kids who don't do any of that, but it's still atypical because they are just echoing what they've heard before and aren't really truly initiating and communicating in a more typical way. So again, sometimes parents might miss children who are verbal, who are on the spectrum, sometimes don't get diagnosed till 3, 4, or even 5, because when pediatricians say, is she talking, the mom thinks, well, yeah, she can quote the whole episode of Dora, or, gosh, she's so smart, she can count to 100, and they say, yeah, she's talking, when a better question might have been, you know, how's she responding, how's she communicating, how is she letting you know what she wants. And again, some of those kids who are echolalic really can pick up on using a phrase or whatever phrase their mom has asked. You know, they may say, again, and it sounds a little odd when you hear it, because you can pick out that they sort of know what they're talking about, because they may say, want a cracker? Want a cracker? Like they're asking a question rather than making a statement, and that's because their moms have said, do you want a cracker? And they've lifted the whole intonation and everything. You know, want to go bye-bye? Want to go bye-bye? You know, they've been able to echo that. And again, they've applied it at a situation that's correct in that that's what they want to do, but there's still some kind of qualitative difference there. And so that lets you know, gosh, something's missing. And we certainly have treated kids like that on our caseloads that are talking, but they're really not communicating yet. And when you look at it, even their social skills, again, while some of these things might be present, they haven't been quite what we could classify as typical. There's just something about it that's a little off. So that's what really lets you know. I need to look at this more closely. I've had lots of little echolalic friends. I think I've probably had more echolalic friends than you've had, Kate, don't you think?
Probably, yes. I would say so, because, I mean, I've certainly had them, but you get them. You tend to get kids in general who are a bit higher functioning than the kids I get, because I'm a DI in your speech.
So, I mean, I have certainly had them, but you probably in general have had more. But I've had them too.
Yeah. And those kinds of kids too, even though they might be reciting long bits of information, like they can read the whole book of Are You My Mother? You know, they quote the whole thing and they say it just like their moms read it to them. Or they know a whole song and can sing it, yet they can't really follow directions. They don't really use language in the way that we would expect it to be. And again, even if, like I was giving the examples about hold you, or want a cracker, they're talking, but it's still not quite what we would want to hear. And a lot of times when we look at those kids, this indicator, they're not really able to initiate communication. Even, you know, and you think, gosh, he knows a lot of words. Why isn't he asking for what he knows? Or, boy, he can label every picture in that book. Or he can, when he watches his favorite DVD, he can quote it. Yet he still can't ask for what he needs, or he can't respond to questions. You know, that lets you know the social piece is really missing. He still doesn't have the ability to be able to use those words to initiate conversations, to make requests, or a lot of times to follow directions with those same words. And, you know, he says ball. So why can't he, when I say go get the ball or bring me the ball, how come he won't do it? You know, even though he can say it, he's still not using it in that typical way. So that's how we differentiate that and tease out exactly what's going on. And I know I've gone in several different directions with this one little milestone, but all of those situations, when you look back at it, whether they're talking, whether they're not talking, it's that knowing that they need to initiate and knowing how to approach other people and communicate in a way to make their needs known. That's the skill that's disrupted in a variety of children with those situations that I just described. So when moms are still left to interpret and read kids' minds when they're two or two and a half, we know that that's a big problem, because that doesn't happen in typical development, and it doesn't even happen in language-delayed kids where expressive language is their only issue, because they've found other ways to communicate, whether it be gestures. A lot of these kids pick up sign language really, really well because they know on some level, I can't talk and I've got to have some way to make my needs known. That's how you differentiate, like you were talking about before, Kate, a child with a more serious, a more significant developmental delay that encompasses lots of areas versus an expressive language problem or a speech sound issue. They can't get all those sounds together, but still you look at those kids and they're still pretty effective communicators even without the words.
Right.
All right. So I don't think I'm going to say any more about that other than let me address one more thing that I say all the time in conferences and that speech pathologists really recognize and appreciate, because we've all had this. Sometimes moms don't even realize, again, that their children aren't initiating communication or initiating this next piece, which is social interaction. Again, they're just responding to their children in the same way of, I have to meet every single need, when they're, you know, 18 months, 24 months, 30 months, almost the same as if when they were 18 days old and 24 days old. You know, they still interpret and anticipate. And those are the moms that typically feel really guilty and feel really, they so internalize their children's delays, like it must have been something I did. I mean, don't you see that going hand in hand, Kate, where moms are so apologetic with, one, they don't even recognize it, and two, when you try to really kind of point those things out, they get really apologetically defensive about it. It must have been something I did. Or they look for external factors. You know, I drank a wine cooler before I knew I was pregnant. Or his daddy and I had a fight when he was 8 months old. Do you think this is the reason he's not talking? I mean, sometimes that really, I see that a lot in those moms. First of all, they don't really realize that they are over-anticipating and that their child's not initiating. And then when you get them to kind of see it, they immediately jump to, oh, it must have been because of this or because of that, rather than there's something really going wrong here. I mean, have you seen that with those kinds of moms?
I have. And you know, Laura, they also say, and I think this is kind of makes sense. The other thing that those same types of moms say is, well, it's my fault because I do everything for him.
Right.
Or I meet all of his needs and I don't expect him to communicate, and so I just don't really give him a chance. And,
right.
You know, a lot of times it's the most responsive, hands-on, dedicated
mommies
who say that.
Right.
And I've had other therapists sometimes kind of encourage moms to feel a little guilty, like they've made this horrible mistake meeting their children's needs. And I always say, look, this is a problem with his communication skills. This is not because you met his every need. Typically, developing kids, even whose needs are being met, talk, or they at least have these social prerequisite skills for talking instinctively. You couldn't keep a child from developing these if everything was developing typically. You couldn't.
Right.
And mom,
right.
You know, it always makes me feel so bad. It's like, you're a great mommy. There is nothing you did that made
this. Yeah, that you could have done or didn't do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you did what a good mommy does, and there is an issue, and that's why it's an issue, not because of. But I have had a fair number of therapists over the years basically tell parents, well, you meet his every need. Why would he talk? And it's like, no, you know, it's really not.
And it is, moms do feel validated and relieved when you say outright, this is not your fault, because they have internalized those issues and say, well, it has to be from me. It can't possibly be. And I always think that it's because their greatest fear is there's something really, really wrong with my child, with how he's developing, and they can't possibly, I mean, that is so, you feel so out of control when you start to really think about it that way. So they had much rather think, this is something I did, this is something I caused, rather than.
And I totally get that. You know,
I
what can
that.
I do? And we are going to help them do some things differently. It's not that they couldn't maybe tweak what they're doing and get better results.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But in and of itself, it is not because mom met his every need. She was a doting, hands-on mom who anticipated. And you couldn't anticipate a typically developing child's every need if that was your mission in life, because they have their own thoughts and ideas, and you may want to give them the Lightning McQueen cup, but they want Buzz Lightyear, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's that basic. There's no way that you could know every little thing. And typically, developing kids let you know whether they have the words or not. So.
Exactly. And so to be able, as a therapist, to say to my mom, this is not something that you caused. This is not something you did. And, again, I can just hear therapists saying to themselves, well, what about if she abused drugs? Or what about if, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about good moms who are trying really hard, often internalize so many of these things. So we need to point blank say, this is not your fault, so that they can move beyond that. But then again, I've already pointed out, moving beyond that is the scariest thing. Often that a mom, the conclusion that she can reach is, oh my goodness, there's something wrong here. And that's often the more difficult underlying truth that's so painful for so many moms to really get to. And so we have to really kind of walk through that. And this is what I usually say at conferences too, is this kind of mom is completely different from the kind of mom that meets you at the door. And you know what I'm going to say, Kay, you get there, and before you can even get in her house, she's saying, he ain't right. Oh, he ain't right. There is something bad wrong with him. He ain't right. I don't know what I'm going to do with this kid. Oh, lady, look, let me tell you how bad it is. And sometimes those moms get the worst kind of thoughts or judgments from therapists because they're saying, oh, my gosh, I can't believe she's saying this. But on some level, that kind of mom is further along than either the mom who completely can't think about something being wrong and internalizes everything and tries to make it about everything except for what it really is, versus, and also the other flip side with a parent who did absolutely nothing to get their child services and they show up, you know, practically nonverbal at kindergarten, and the therapist is thinking, where the heck have you been? You should have been on somebody's caseload when you were 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and now you're showing up at 5. Where have your parents and the pediatrician been on this? Because you are horribly unprepared for kindergarten. And so the moms who meet us at the door with he ain't right, he ain't right, or even the worst moms on our caseload that you think, oh, my gosh, how can a kid be living in this environment unless we are there by court order? They have already done at least one thing right, which is get their kid assessed and help. And again, sometimes I think therapists get a little too judgmental with that kind of mother who is so blatantly honest and so not in denial about what's really going on with her kid. And I appreciate those moms. I just appreciate where they are because I can say, you are exactly right. We need to get him some help, and you have done the right thing by getting him enrolled in services. And sometimes I think that's new information for therapists to think about. But you're right, I love your point with a lot of times therapists do say, well, you've met his every need, you've anticipated, blah, blah, blah. When and they've made it like it's that whole cause, you know, you're the reason this has happened, when it really...
And normally I think, and this is just me talking, but I see that happen most often with kids who have motor planning problems, and their social skills are pretty good, but they're not using words.
Right.
And that parents, I mean, therapists will tell parents, and I think, no way. If he could pop out a word, he would.
He
would, because they have their own ideas.
Easier.
Right, it's easier. But the flip side of that, Laura, I have a case right now, without being too revealing, it's a situation where the child definitely has social weaknesses, let's say, or his prerequisite social skills are not intact. And coupled with that, it is not the most nurturing, sensory-rich environment you would ever want to be in. It's not great, and mom has a lot on her plate, and the kid doesn't get much attention. But I've pretty much heard the other therapist on the team, the person doing the paperwork, and the new preschool teacher theorized that it's probably a nurture issue. It's probably, in other words, the mother.
Right, the environment's bad. Yeah.
It is, and it is bad. I mean, it's not great at all. But I don't believe for a minute that just as you couldn't keep a child from talking who could talk by meeting his every need, I feel like she is being harshly judged, and these issues with this child are being attributed to her less than great parenting skills. And I think, no, you know, she didn't create
him
either.
Yeah, if he were typically developing, he would be okay anyway. He would be okay. He may not have as rich a vocabulary as you would want a child to have, but he would be communicating on a really basic level, and he's not able to do that. And I mean, this is the example that I give to therapists all the time when I'm talking about this in conferences, and I can see that people are sitting there kind of not buying that whole theory, the whole can't versus won't. And we have talked about this on the show. Sometimes we'll be working with a 2-year-old or a 2-and-a-half-year-old older sibling, and they will have a 12-month-old, 15-month-old, 18-month-old sibling that is running circles around them cognitively. You know, we're cueing a word with the almost 3-year-old, and the baby is sitting over there screaming, "Bubble! Go!" You know, and same bad environment, same mom who's less than attentive, same.
Yeah, probably got a little less attention since there was a 3-year-old, in front, or a 2-year-old in front of that 1-year-old. But the 1-year-old is doing really well, at least, you know, typical. And the one we're
and responding.
With.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always, when I had that happen, I haven't had it happen in a long time, but I really say to parents and I point out, see, this is the difference. She's wired differently than him. She came into this world with her little brain being different, whether you're talking about you're the child that you're seeing and you're meaning that, you know, he didn't start out with as ready a system to be able to learn all this language stuff as your other baby over here. And that's the point I try to make with therapists. We often have younger siblings who are outpacing our child that we're working with, and even though that they live in those same circumstances. So you can't always blame it on that whole nurture environment stuff. Nature has a whole lot to do with that. And
right.
You hate to say to a mom, neurologically, she's got more going on than him, maturation-wise or whatever you want to say. And, again, it's hard to even word that to talk about it to a parent. But it's true in so many instances with the kids that we see is they just weren't – they didn't come to this world with the same potential or same set of hardwiring as – other children who are not struggling developmentally. And we have to keep that in mind. And while it's hard as a speech pathologist to be able to sit there and say he's got a neurological difference, I mean, yeah, are we ever going to be able to see it on an MRI or anything like that or an objective test? No. But just looking at him developmentally, you know there is something inherently not working in the way that we would want it to work or we would be seeing more skills with language or cognition or motor or whatever realm you're looking at. So, I mean, that's a discussion that's, oh, gosh, it's so hard to have with a parent. Yet sometimes when you point those things out, it's almost easier for a parent to understand. And it's really good when a therapist makes that connection that, oh, gosh, even though this mom is lousy or this home environment is not what we would want, it's still not the reason that this kid isn't moving along developmentally. And
right,
certainly
which
a point
is kind
that
of what I've
consider.
Tried to say, because I keep hearing that theory posed with this child. Well,
right.
I don't think the home environment's great. Well, I don't think he gets much attention. Well, I think, you know, and all those things are true. On the other hand, I don't believe for a minute that they created what's going on with this child. This is
right.
The way he is.
Right. Mm-hmm. And granted, if those other things had been better, he may be further along developmentally, but it probably would not have prevented totally what you're seeing. Yeah, and that's hard for a lot of therapists to recognize, and it's harder for them to talk about with a parent because they feel like that they're out of their realm. You know, I'm not a doctor. I can't say that. That sort of thing, but you know that that's true. Even if this kid had been in the most loving home and in the most language-enriched environment ever, he still would have had those developmental problems because that's, again, just who he is. It's just what he came into this world with. And not that therapy doesn't make a difference or that good parenting doesn't make a difference. It certainly does. But at the end of the day, some of these kids just neurologically are atypical. They have atypical systems. And that's
right.
Just a fact. No matter if they were born in an orphanage, you know, or in an orphanage in Russia or in a well-to-do home in the United States, they would still have developmental problems because their underlying system is not what we would hope it to be. And so I do think it's a good point to try to make, although I don't know why so many therapists blame things on bad parenting. I don't know why they do. I don't know why they do. Or, you know, and an extension of that is blaming everything on behavior. If their
right.
mom could just make a mind, you know, and boy, you know, we've talked that to death on previous shows, so we're not going to go there now. But it is really funny how a lot of therapists and parents of children who have these kinds of delays tell me that their family members being so judgmental to them are
mm-hmm.
so, you know, that's such an issue for them. You know, they'll say, if you spanked him, he would talk. Or if you spanked him, he would not act like this, you know, when there's
or put him in time out
issues.
Or
yeah.
tell him
yeah.
no more or, yeah,
right.
or fill in the blank. In other words, if you were a more effective parent, your child wouldn't have these issues. And, I mean, you know, we can certainly have an effect on our children, but the truth is the kids we're talking about, they have inborn issues, whether we like it or not, and all we can do
right.
is help the mom to deal with those issues to the best of her ability and do what we can when we're there. But it doesn't mean that she created them.
Exactly.
Other than in the most biblical sense of the word, she may have created them, but it's
right.
not because she didn't talk to them or discipline them or, you
or
know,
any
all
of those other
things.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's just not. Developmental issues are not created because of that. And so we do have to look at what our kids' underlying, you know, neurotypical systems versus atypical systems. And when you start with that and look at it from that perspective, it is guilt-relieving for lots of moms. And even if they, you know, still feel a lot of that internal angst, it's shifted in that, you know, my sweet little baby, what am I going to do to help him versus, oh my gosh, I have caused all this. So I think it's an important thing to talk about with parents, and I'm glad we got to have that talk here on the show. Okay, let's move on to this next one. Really goes hand in hand with what we've been talking about. Works to get your attention when he needs you, and it would also be that a child is able to initiate that social interaction too. And this would be where it's an extension of what we've just talked about, where kids initiate those fun little social routines with us too, and where we've already talked about in previous shows how they respond to those, meaning that we don't have to work very hard to get and sustain their attention. They want us. They want to be with us. They initiate all those cute little things. In addition to getting their needs met, it goes beyond that, where they communicate with us or they want to interact with us just for the sake of being with us. And again, sometimes moms miss this because they interpret that physical connection that they have with their child, meaning he wants to snuggle into them and twist her hair while he's falling asleep, or he wants to touch her face or whatever little ritual they have going on. They interpret that to mean, oh, he's initiating social interaction with me. But when you really look at it objectively, it's that physicalness that they have. And we've talked about that on a previous show in this series, Kate, where we were saying that a child might... It's that first week when we were saying that a kid wants to be with you, but again, there's not that back and forth.
Truly social interaction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is physical.
Yeah.
And I think that for parents, that is an inherently very social thing, and I see why parents are confused by that or misinterpret what the child is seeking. You know what I mean? Because
yeah, totally.
You never feel emotionally closer to your child than when you're hugging them or kissing them
right.
or rocking them or, you know, snuggling with them. I mean, I think it is very emotional. It's just not really social the way that kids typically do it. It's really about hold me, rub me, you know, let me squish
right.
into you, let me snuggle your hair.
Right.
I don't, it's not really all that social.
Yeah, and if there is work to be done on that level, it's the parent doing all of the work to make
mm-hmm.
sure, that the socialness is there. We have a little boy on our caseload right now that you see Kate and I see too, and his mom is quite adept with him at getting a social response now, but boy, is she working hard to do it with
right.
all of her little sensory pieces that she interprets. You know, she rolls on top of him and she gets right in his face and he rides on her back and all of those things, and she is a phenomenal mother, and she does OT with him so many hours of the day with all the sensory input that he gets. But unless she is working really, really hard, you can't really identify any social responsiveness on this child's part. It's not
no.
there.
It's
unless
all very
she's doing all
on
the work.
Her part. Yes. And
right.
if she's really, really, really forcing it, on a good day you see a little response.
A little her. Hint.
Yes, but never is he actively seeking it or working
initiating
for it.
Initiating it. Yeah.
yeah.
And
the
he might initiate
part,
the
yes.
physical part, yeah.
But
not,
the
social
part.
Part. Yeah, and mm-hmm. that's what a lot of moms can miss. And therapists can even miss that too. Yeah, therapists
mm-hmm.
might see that and say, oh, look right there, he's social. Check it, move on. And then you're not thinking about the work the adult is doing to make that possible. That's why therapists miss this, and we talked about this on last week's show, where they say, this child can't possibly be on the spectrum because he responds to me during therapy. Well, if you can't get him to respond after all of your professional education, I don't know who can. And so you can't even use that as a measure. You've got to be looking at this child over the course of his entire day or week or whatever, and look at socialness that way, not when the adult is working overtime to make that happen. It should just be instinctive. It should just happen without lots of additional effort. And the part that we're talking about right now, so the child should really initiate this. The most glaring example I see of this with a typically developing kid versus a child who's atypical is that, and I remember my babies doing this to me, and even some of my little friends will do this to me during therapy. If I'm talking to their moms too much, they grab my face with their hands and make me look at them. They might have whined or done some other things to try to get my attention, but that's the mark of a really typically developing kid, is when they take
yeah.
your face in their hands like, look at me, look at me, to
yeah.
redirect
Which
your
part
attention.
Of pay attention to me don't you get, all without a word.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They've initiated that, and it's very social when it happens because they are looking right at you like, hey, what about me? Yeah, so.
Well, and Laura, I think of the kids that I've had now and in the past that I have worked, and one of my go-to early ones is try and ride a little horsey to see what I get socially. And, you know, you wrote
right.
the book on teach your my baby to, what is it? Teach your baby.
Teach me to play with you.
Teach
with
me
you.
To play with you. That's right. I've got the
yeah.
baby in there. Teach me to play with you. Anyway, in there is ride a little horsey, but I try that a lot, and I think of some of the kids I've had over the years that I had to work and work and work and work and encourage mom to do the same routine weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, sometimes months before the kid is looking at me. The kid is smiling. The kid is wiggling to tell me, ride the horsey again. You know,
right.
I'm getting virtually no response. Or
right.
I'm getting, they want down, they want away, or they're just kind of out there.
Going through the motions.
I've
yeah.
got my face in his face. I'm smiling. I'm, you know, doing everything I can to get his attention. And what I see back is virtually nothing. And,
right.
you know, sometimes it can take repeated exposures till you get the desired response.
Yeah. And so when you're working that hard, when an adult has to work that hard, that should just be an automatic, oh, my goodness, he doesn't respond. Or, you know, and those kids can't even initiate that kind of social thing with you because children have to respond first before
mm-hmm.
they can initiate it. So that should just be a big red flag to tell you he doesn't have the social skill prerequisite to be able to communicate, and so I've got to work on this first. And so when an adult is doing all that hard work, that's a big red flag. And I'm glad you brought up Teach Me to Play with You, because that therapy manual is, and I talked about it a lot last week, but it is, the whole darn thing is filled with social routines and ways to work on these kinds of these milestones with joint attention and eye contact and turn-taking and learning to respond and learning to initiate. It's filled with that, and it's in a homework format so that a therapist can get it, use one of the little routines in therapy with a child, photocopy the activity, and then give it to a parent for homework, so then the parent has access to that visual reminder, excuse me, of what they're supposed to be doing, but that child said that they can carry over that. So Teach Me to Play With You, and that, like I said at the beginning of the show, will be on sale as soon as we're finished with the show today, and I can put it on there. All right, let's finish this last indicator and this last skill that we look at, and we talked about it earlier, so we're not going to talk about it for very long, but it's we have to see some evidence of purposeful activity in play, and there has to be a social component with that. And by that, I mean that children give you evidence that they are thinking and remembering and learning, and that there's a socialness to that, and that you understand that they are planning their play and that their play isn't just random. We all of us who work in early intervention have, and I know we've talked about this on the show before, kids that we would consider or classify as roamers, or kids who are not very productive or purposeful in their play at home, meaning they just kind of go from thing to thing to thing, and may not even play with the toys. They just kind of walk around their houses all day. Their parents can leave them for a while in their rooms and come back, and they're really pretty much doing the same thing, which is just maybe kind of flitting around from toy to toy, but no real
playing. That's my term. They're flitterers. They just kind of touch things, but they don't really engage with things
much. Yeah.
They might push some buttons to see the lights and the sounds go off, but, you know, left to their own devices, generally don't just instinctively sit and play with things much at all.
And so if you were observing them, you would see a whole lot of nothing. If you were really looking for evidence of skill or play or anything, everything looks really random and really passive. And so when I say to my mom, what does he like to play with, and she for a two-year-old, and she says nothing, okay, that lets me know there's probably not much going on play-wise. He doesn't have enough of a cognitive base. Motor skills aren't there, whatever. Usually it's kind of a global problem when a mom says that a two-year-old doesn't really like anything to play with. You know, that
right.
lets you know right there. The biggest example that I can contrast atypical development with typical development in the sense is that when you're in a therapy session and you have one of your toys and you're playing with a toy, and a kid all of a sudden looks at you, jumps up, runs to his bedroom, and then comes back with a toy that goes perfectly with what you're playing with. And he tells you by that action, even without words, I have an idea. And that idea, you know, he's remembered that he had this toy that would go beautifully with what you're doing. He planned, boy, I'm going to jump up and run, go get that from my room. And then the social part of that is, I'm going to bring that back to Kate so she can see it and we can play with this together. And so when you don't see that, you know, that even when the, I mean, look at how much information that gives you. That tells you, again, cognitively, with a kid who's done that, cognitively he's moving along and he remembers things and he can plan his next move. And then the social piece of that, he brought it back to share with you and show you, I want to do this. And again, without all of those pieces being there, that kid's not really ready to communicate yet and not developmentally ready to learn how to talk yet. And usually those are the kids, again, that don't understand very much language either, because they're not even purposeful. They haven't been purposeful enough with what they've been doing to even link meaning with what their parents, the words their parents have been saying to them all along. So usually when we see that, there's a pretty big receptive language issue going on as well. And most of the time with all these things that we've talked about, when we see children with these social skill deficits, usually in the birth to three population, they do have pretty significant receptive language problems too. And a lot of times therapists miss that and haven't thought about that either. But if you look at it from a purely logical perspective, if they haven't been clued in enough with other people to consistently interact with them, they probably haven't been able to understand and link meaning with the words that other people have said to them too. They're missing that core, I want to be with other people, so language doesn't make sense to them yet either. But again, that's not something that people, that you learn in grad school. I don't remember anybody ever really telling me that, but it certainly is true when you start to look at the kids on our birth to three caseloads. The children with the most significant social deficits also, in 99.9% of cases, also have a pretty significant receptive language problem too, although that's not always spelled out in black and white.
No, but you're, like you said, it only makes sense.
Right.
They tend to be the kids who don't show much response at all to language, you know.
Yeah, they're avoiders.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes parents assign that as a, you know, a personality thing. Oh, he's thinking about something else, or he doesn't like that, so he's not going to pay attention. When really at the core issue, you know, it's always a social and sensory processing / huge developmental problem. It's the
right.
reason that he's avoided, not all those other things that parents try to assign. So with that, we want to see evidence of that purposeful activity in play and also that social component with that, because that lets us know, again, that a child is moving along developmentally and all those things are coming together so that he or she is ready to learn language. And when we, so many of these skills that we've talked about over the last 5 weeks, it's been so hard to really isolate and talk about one particular skill because it almost always bleeds over with another one of those milestones. But when you look at all of these indicators together, and when you see, start to see that a child is, and we've, in the first couple of shows, I really was very purposeful about saying quantitative and qualitative differences. When you see that these things are missing in a child, this is where you start therapy. This is where you start to work with him, because this is his core deficit. And when you can get a little better responses, and when you start to see some of these things come on in, then you know that the child is at a better place and is developmentally more ready to learn language than if you had just started with activities and paid no attention to his social responses at all. So that's the whole reason that we've done this series of shows, is to talk about what those social skills are, talk about why they're important, give you ways to recognize those things, and more importantly, give you ways to work on those things in therapy sessions. And that would be even mommy therapy sessions by parents. So I hope that the series has been helpful. If you have any other questions after listening to these 5 shows, email me and we will try to address those. But for now, I think we have pretty much discussed to death the key social skills required for toddlers before they're ready to learn language. What do you think, Kate?
Well, we have ad nauseum, Laura, but it is such a prevalent thing because of so many kids being on the spectrum nowadays.
Right.
It's a matter of degree, and these skills vary with that degree. In other words,
right.
The most autistic children, boom, 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 check, 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 check. You won't see any of these things. Those kids who are on the spectrum but may be higher functioning than the most autistic child, you'll see some of these skills in a weak fashion. But
right.
Is the quality there? No. You know, so.
Right. Is the quantity
anyway,
there? No. Not unless
no.
The adult is really working hard. Yeah.
Right.
So I hope that this series has been helpful. And if again, we love to hear feedback from moms and dads and therapists who
yep.
have.
I want to add this one little tidbit, Laura.
Go ahead.
The flitters, those kids, when we ask, you know, what does Johnny like to play with? And she says, well, not much of anything. The other thing I hear a lot with that is, say the child's 2 okay, 24 months. And I say, what does Johnny like to play with? What's his favorite toys? What are his favorite toys? A lot of times I hear, I'm knocking them again, the bells and whistles toys. It's the, the electronic,
right,
battery-operated, yes, leapfrog type toy, maybe
ABC-based,
maybe colors, maybe numbers, maybe all of the above. And the child is just kind of mindlessly pushing the buttons, and there doesn't seem to be any awareness on their part of what it means, or they're not really absorbing the information. It's just they like the bells and whistles, and they push buttons.
Right.
And a lot of times that is the answer you get with those kids. You know, if he stops to do much of anything, it's a battery-operated toy where he's just pushing the buttons. And kids who have more of them might go to the next one, but they're really not understanding or processing. It's just kind of mindless button pushing. But just for the moms, I wanted to put that out there because I hear that a lot with these kids. Mom says,
he really likes
that telephone game there where you push the buttons and it has the numbers. But when you watch them do it, there's really no purposeful play. It's just push the buttons, activate the battery, and it goes off. And I can see why moms think that's playing, but for a two-year-old, you know, that's really low play. You know,
it's really low play. And when kids are doing that, if we looked at them in a cognitive kind of play, analytical phase that we've talked about on the show before, they're still stuck in cause and effect, which is, 6 to 12 months. And they're really there, and the only thing they can really do is push the button and see the light and push the button and see the light. There's no real, again, the planning piece isn't there, the memory piece isn't there. Sometimes even if kids are more verbal and they do tend to lean toward being echolalic, they even start to repeat some of those letters. And boy, don't moms and dads get excited when a kid tries to say the darn ABCs.
He's learning his ABCs. Yeah, I'm like, he doesn't know what a dog is. He doesn't know what a shoe is. Does it really matter if he knows what a D is?
Yeah. Not at all. I put an article on TeachMeToTalk.com's Facebook page yesterday about that. It was I linked it from the Brain Insights lady that I've talked about before.
Right.
And she I go to TeachMeToTalk.com's Facebook page, and you'll see it there. I listed it. It's a great explanation of why teaching the alphabet and those other pre-academic concepts aren't the best way to spend time with our toddlers, and that children need real language experiences to learn how to talk and what words mean. And so take a look at that if any of our listeners haven't thought about that before, or if they're a therapist and need some more ammunition to use with parents about why those things aren't so great for kids. That's a that article is there. And her website in general, she just writes little snippets of things. So for some people like me that, you're wanting more in-depth information, but you can get some good links from her as to, and some little sound bites, some snippets that you could use when you're talking to parents about those things and have a good explanation that a parent could understand of why it's not such a good idea to encourage those things and how those types of I always think about those types of learning experiences take away from better ways that you could spend your time with the kids. So maybe that'll help some therapy.
Well, I just wanted to mention that for parents who might be listening.
Yeah.
And think, oh, well, he really likes his ABC 1-2-3 push the button ding 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 toy, and he'll do that for a really long time, so he's not a flitter. That's fine if he's 6, 7, 8, 9 months old, but if he's past 12 months, that is not a typical thing for him to want to, or her to want to do for any length of time at all. So I don't mean to scare parents, but I know sometimes the littlest things we say are the things that kind of
significant for parents.
Yeah, that parents say, oh, well, then I can worry about that, or I don't have to worry about that.
Right.
And I would just want to clarify that so that parents know that really isn't the kind of play we're talking about.
And that's why on lots of these scales that people, lots of these scales that are you worried about autism with your child or whatever, they might say has a lack of pretend play. What they really should say is, child is only interested in bell and whistle toys. I mean, that would be a more accurate description rather than doesn't show evidence of pretend play, because that's what it really means, is that the child isn't, you know, can't get past that earliest level of cause and effect, or I do this and this happens, and that would be a better explanation for parents. So I'm glad you brought that up. That was a great point. Great point.
Okay,
and with that, we are going to end this series. Next week, let's talk about, remember at the beginning of the fall when we talked about play routines for, you know, carry people through Halloween and Thanksgiving. Let's talk about fun little routines to use for Christmas, since we're 3 days away from December. And so we'll talk about that, and then I also want to talk about the new DVD, which I hope will be on sale by the time we have the show next week. So that's what's in store for next Sunday night.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right, thanks. Talk to
you
later.
Bye.
Bye.